everything that you do out there on that field is being recorded. You have to have the muster to withstand the criticism that's going to come in that meeting room.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Pete Olushoga, and this is 80% Mental, a podcast all about the psychology of sport and performance. Only a handful of episodes left in this third series now, in which I've been exploring the mental aspects of as many different areas of performance as I can, from ultra endurance events to speeding around a track at 250 miles an hour, from the performing arts on stage and screen to rowing across the Atlantic. And with a couple of episodes left, I wanted to explore something new. Now, I've been a fan of American football, and I have to call it American football because the podcast in the UK. But I've been a fan of American football since my brother and I stayed up late to watch Super Bowl 20, and I'm showing my age there. There's no denying the strategy, the undeniable levels of skill and the precision involved, but it's also a sport a little bit like rugby in the UK, where a good part of your time is spent picking yourself up off the floor after being knocked on your ass. And I want to find out a little bit about the psychology involved in collision sports. What are the unique challenges of just taking massive hit after massive hit, or even dishing out massive hit after massive hit? And as usual, I've got some very, very special guests to help me dive into the topic. So it's my great pleasure to introduce to you my first guest, Dwight Hollier, Senior Associate Athletics Director for Student Athlete Health and Wellbeing at the University of North Carolina. Dwight's mission and goal is assisting current and former athletes in achieving optimal wellness. Dwight, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Doc. I appreciate being here, looking forward to the conversation. And I will just put it out there. I did more hitting than taking hits. just need to put that out there.
No, absolutely. Because you have a whole lot of experience, right? You spent, was it 8 years in the NFL?
Nine. Yeah. Eight Who's in counting? Miami, one in Indianapolis. Oh, I'm awesome. Definitely counting.
Awesome. Well, we will get into some of that a little bit later on, I'm sure. But really appreciate you taking some time out this afternoon to come and talk to us. And to help us get into the psychology behind the performance, I'm really pleased to be able to welcome my second guest, performance consultant and therapist, Dr. Adrian Ferreira. Now, over his career, Dr. Adrian has served in the spaces of high performance and mental health. He's had the privilege to work with special operations soldiers, athletes at the pro, collegiate, and high school levels, in addition to business professionals who want to improve performance and well-being. Adrian, welcome to the podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. Always a pleasure. Dwight, great to see you again. Great to be in your presence. Full disclosure, I've never played football. Don't hit me. I'm a basketball player. Breathe on me. That's a foul. So I'll throw that out there right now. But definitely have had the pleasure to work with several football athletes in addition to working specifically with a football team.
Yeah.
Amazing experience. So never done it, but worked with a lot who have.
Fantastic. I was going to say, obviously, you're here as the mental performance consultant, but like, what is your background as an athlete? Did you compete?
So played college basketball at the University of Laverne, and I'm currently in this transition of figuring out my new identity and trying to shift to being a skateboarder.
Oh, wow.
Cool. Well, we had Stevie Bell, the snowboarder, on the previous episode. So I know he's doing some kind of skateboarding as well. But yeah, check out that episode after you finish listening to this one.
Most definitely.
All right. Well, I'm really glad that you're both able to join me today, and I can't wait to hear your insights and your experiences about the psychology of the clash, collision sports. So, Dwight, I'm gonna start with you. And I guess like my first question is, why would you put your body through that? You know, what is it about the sport that kind of drew you in the first place?
Can I just say that's a great opening question? Why do that? I'm curious to know too. Why would you do that?
Well, I really do appreciate the question. There's a lot that goes into the answer. I, you know, But I'll start with love. The love I developed for the sport early on, and you know, got it honestly. I have a brother who's 6 years older than me, and he was an athlete. He played. My dad coached Little League. In fact, the first football team that I played on, he didn't coach my team, but he was a coach of one of the coaches in the league. And because he was one of the coaches in the league, I got a chance to play early. So you were supposed to be, I believe, 8 years old to play on the team that I ended up playing on for the first year that I played organized football. And I was seven. But they allowed me to play. Had no idea what I was doing. They put me at safety and to keep me safe. You know, safety was the furthest away from the ball, and I learned to come up and make plays eventually. But when I talk about love, it was love because it was, you know, from as early as I can remember, we played football in the yard. We played football in the street. We played a game called Kill the Man. And if you'd never heard of Kill the Man was a game that, you know, you go and stand in the yard with, didn't matter how many people were there, you throw the ball up in the air. Whoever caught the ball, they get tackled. You try to kill the man, and the guy who catches the ball is he tries to get to what would be, you know, whatever barrier we set up as a touchdown zone. And kill the man helped me to become ultimately the linebacker that I became. You know, it was really about mastering the skill of fearless hitting. And that love that I developed, and I have to give it up to my neighborhood in the young years when I was playing, lived on a street called Kelly Avenue. And we would play football all times of the day until the street lights came on. We called ourselves the Kelly Cowboys. We would take drywall from old houses and draw. We had a couple of people, one in particular that was a really good artist, and he would draw the star on the street and the Cowboys logo at the telephone pole, which was the end zone. We played telephone pole to telephone pole, and we play against other neighborhoods. And you know, those years helped formulate the real love that I had. And so, you know, I talk about love, I talk about my neighborhood, and neighborhood heroes. And my brother was one of those neighborhood heroes that I looked up to. And so he was playing, and I looked up to him. I looked up to other players. I was a Cowboys fan early on in the late 70s, early 80s, telling my age. I am no longer a Cowboys fan. I just want to put that out there too.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah, let's no. I separated ways long before I got drafted by the Dolphins. But definitely separated ways from them. Had a lot to do with them firing Tom Landry. So just saying. And you know, and at some point, somebody told me I was good. Or good enough, and that just sort of solidified that bond I had with that sport. And to go along with that, and this is a long answer to a short question, the strategy, the one-on-ones amongst the team atmosphere, like all of that stuff, really. I connect with on a deep down personal level.
So at what point, you know, you talk about the love of the sport as a kid growing up, but at what point did it become something that was more serious, you know, like this could really be a career for me?
Probably the middle school years when I was playing JV football. Again, there were coaches and players who would mention that, you know, you're okay, you know, you're pretty good. And that inspired me to keep pushing and trying harder. But it didn't really click with me until my junior year of high school. My junior year, I was a starter on varsity and made second team all conference and started to get mail from schools asking for, you know, to fill out the information form and send it back in. And that was my, oh, maybe I can do this on the next level. I think that was the time when it really started to click with me.
And just to kind of bring Adrian in here, we're hearing about this period of time in kind of high school, that transition through adolescence, where we kind of start to take things a little bit more seriously, maybe. What kind of age athletes do you work with? Is this something that you've come across, this sort of transition period through adolescence?
No, definitely. So I would say the youngest high school athletes I tend to work with are 13, 14, because I think from a developmental standpoint, are they ready to have the conversations that are going to help them get to the next level, specifically like how I work and the people I work with. I've been trained and working with college athletes between the ages of 18 to 25. And I've recently shifted to business professionals who are mid-30s, mid-40s, right? Mm-hmm. So the conversation with a 12-year-old, we're not on the same page. But I think about some of the high school athletes I have worked with, some definitely come to mind where very similar to what Dwight is saying. I'm getting letters in the mail. I have the height. I got the skill. Someone said like, hey, you could do this. And they're like, oh crap, I'm ready to go. Or they're realizing they're really good, but there's something that's just like not clicking or something's a little off. The confidence is there, but not there all the time. I think that comes up for many of my athletes that I work with of I want to have the right mindset going into every game, going into every competition, into every match. So in my eyes, I hear there's an awareness that I need to do something different, or there's an awareness that I need to do something more. And that's where I get the email from a parent or an email from, it's usually from a parent with my high school athletes. Everyone who's older is usually, they're reaching out on their own. And even when I was in the college setting, for many of the athletes I worked with, I would say they're at that high level Division I and they realize I'm not as good as everybody else anymore. Everybody else here is good. Yeah. I need the next advantage. Or this is so stressful. How do I continue to do this for 4 or 5 years and put my body through this, the sacrifice, the grind, specifically like football athletes? Like Dwight, hats off to you. When I say like, who's counting? Like I said that in joke, but when you say like nine's different than eight, eight's different than seven. There's a lot more hits that are happening. I think one of the quotes I heard from a football player, I think this when I was down at Auburn, he said, there's only so much free football I can play.
Yes, sir.
Of like the hits they take, the injuries, even something as minor of like my toe hurts is a big deal. When you got someone who's running full speed at you or you have to go run full speed at them, if your toe is hurting, it's a different ball game.
Yeah.
You gotta make calculations.
Right. And that's like very fast. And it has to be there top speed. So definitely like hats off to all those who do play American football. And it's just a different ball game, a different beast. Also knowing that there's someone like trying to take your spot every single day.
Yeah, yeah. And I was gonna say, you know, talking about that period of kind of adolescence into early adulthood and kind of making those sorts of transitions. Like, is it different in this type of sport? You know, you mentioned those physical demands. It's like a physically demanding sport, right? More so than basketball that I played, right? So like what are the specific mental challenges maybe that go along with some of those physical demands for, I guess we're talking about adolescence, like for kids of that age, like what are the mental demands here?
That demand, I think hits in a couple of different ways. One is, you talked about the physical demands of playing the sport. But it's also, there's a difference in losing and getting beat, and you can do both, but getting beat has an impact on a psyche when you're in a defensive back, wide receiver space and you get beat as a wide receiver, you get beat as a defensive back, or you're an offensive lineman against a defensive lineman and you get beat. And that happens more than once or repeatedly. It takes an emotional toll on a person. It can hurt confidence. It can cause people to walk away. And during those young formative years, there's a lot of walking away. There's a lot of guys who don't play football, whose last time they played football was Little League. And then you come to the next level and the last time they play football, and good riddance, in their mind, good riddance, I'm glad this is done, I don't have to play this anymore, is in middle school or moving up to high school, because it can take a huge toll emotionally on who you are as a person. If you can't compete, what does that mean for me? Who am I? It can be challenging because sometimes in some spaces, particularly for big people, the world is telling them they should be this. And they get out there and they can't meet the expectations. And the world is still telling them they should be this. You're a big guy. You should be playing football. But football hasn't been kind to them. And football doesn't agree with who they are. But the world's still telling them they should be this. So it's a difficult place to be. And a lot of transitions out of the game happen during those formative years.
Yeah, Adrian, is that something that you see a lot of? That I'm interested in that kind of pull between you should be playing this sport, you should be good at that sport, that kind of pressure almost that's placed on young athletes to be doing this. And, Dwight, you mentioned there that sense of relief almost, oh, thank God, I don't have to do this anymore. Is that something you've come across?
Oh, most definitely. I think about, Dwight touched on this, of like transitions. Let's say you're a high school athlete. You're getting all these letters in the mail, and then you show up day one of camp, and you may get your ass kicked. For years, people have been kissing your ass and saying you're good. We want you to come here. You're great. We think you can start right away. And then you get here, and there's this 23-year-old who's looking at you as an 18-year-old like, I'm going to kick your ass. You're not taking my spot. Like, what kind of mind game is that, right? Everyone's kissed your ass. You're so good. No, you're not. I'm going to show you. And the speed is different. The size is different. The angles are different. We're talking about angles, right? Like, the precision that someone else has, and they just have 4 years on you, and you still got to show up and perform. And then when you get your ass kicked that one day, you got to go back tomorrow. And then you got to show up the next day. And then you got to show up the next day after that. And we're only like 1 week into camp. Right? So just think about that mental toll. If someone goes, let's say someone's going to a summer camp that they just get beat up every single day. And you go do that for 4 years of college. Like, that's wild. So I do think about the commitment to the grind, which I've talked to like several of my clients about. And I think from the mental side, there's a decision that has to be made at some point that says, hey, I'm going to do this, knowing that it's going to be a struggle, knowing that I have guys who are bigger than me. I have to get in the weight room at 6 a.m. I have to hit the weights harder. I have to make sure I eat so I'm fueling myself. I have to make the right decisions throughout the day to give myself just the best fighting chance to get through tomorrow. Right. And even if you're really good, that's fine. Are you going to stay that way for 4 years? Because once you get through your freshman year, guess what? There's another group of freshmen who's coming right behind you, ready to take your spot.
Yeah.
And then when you're a junior, there's another group of freshmen, and that sucker just recycles day after day after day. So, like, think about the emotional toll like Dwight is talking about. This is like a constant. Coaches never stop recruiting. They're always looking for the next best. There's always someone who is here to replace you.
Yeah.
So I think like athletes really have to be more calculated in the decisions that they do, the right ones and the wrong ones. Because you make the wrong decision, you can be in the doghouse and good luck trying to get out. You can make the right decisions and there's someone who's still better than you. So sometimes it almost feels like a lose-lose, but sometimes it can be a win-win because you always have to like commit back to the battle and commit to the decision to like commit to the grind. So yeah, like so that's true. A long process.
So true. And I just want to add that same process happens in the NFL when your job is on the line.
It doesn't stop.
When your job is on the line, they're going to bring in every year, they bring in the next greatest model. You know, the upgraded model of athlete to take your job, and it happens year after year after year, and it really does test who you are.
I'm interested because so far, all of the kind of mental challenges that we've talked about are off the field stuff, right? It's the pressure, it's the transitions through high school and college, and the pressure of the kind of new group coming through and losing your spot. What we haven't really talked about is, you know, the on the field stuff. And, you know, Dwight, 9 years in the NFL, talk to me a little bit about some of the mental challenges of that. Is that more off the field stuff, or, you know, are there kind of mental challenges of playing the game? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's definitely some strategy. You know, one, you have to be good enough to be there. There's a lot of evaluations that are going on. And one thing that we like to say is the eye in the sky don't lie. And so you have to perform every day. You got to show up every day. And everything that you do out there on that field is being recorded. And right after you finish that practice, you're going to go in and watch what was recorded. And so you have to show up. You have to be precise. You have to be on top of your game. You have to understand the scheme and operate under pressure repeatedly. And again, you have to have the muster to withstand the criticism that's going to come in that meeting room, and then. You do that day after day, and then you go. So along with that, you have to perform better than the guy that's behind you, because he can step in and take your job. And so you need to perform well. You can't be looking over your shoulder. So how do you manage all of that pressure? It's really challenging. And then, One of the things that I loved about playing in Miami was it was just a great atmosphere. I played for some unbelievable Hall of Fame coaches, Don Shula and Jimmy Johnson, and two great coaches, couldn't be more different personality wise. And one of the things I loved about Jimmy Johnson is, if there was a position that had a bad game on Sunday, that Monday, whatever position that was, let's say it's an offensive lineman, offensive guards struggled to keep the quarterback safe. That Monday morning, there would be six free agent offensive guards that are paraded through the locker room and walk out onto the field to try out
Wow.
And sometimes somebody got cut and they hired one of those guys. But it was position after position, Monday after Monday. Talk about pressure. There's an additional pressure to perform well. Otherwise, you're going to see dudes that look like you coming into that locker room to take your job. And it never failed. It was one of the most interesting psychological mind games that I got to witness during my time in the NFL. And it's fun to laugh at now, but during that time, it was stress. It was definitely stress.
Adrian, what are you making of that as a coaching strategy?
If I said it worked.
Very successful.
So I think there's some piece to it, right? Of like, would I do that as a coach? I don't know, but I think coaches always try to figure out what's going to work, what's going to help my team. As I think about football, and I love how you titled this like the clash, right? But I think we always see the helmet hitting, the hard hits. But what I don't think is showcased enough, and I've been privileged to see behind the scenes, you got to have some type of smarts to play football. Mm. The amount of film that dudes watch is incredible.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, because I've watched the sport for so long, I never got to play it, but I watched it for so long. And I think that the casual observer doesn't really get the amount of precision that's involved.
Right.
Like the skill is obvious to see it, but the mm-hmm. precision that's involved at every position as well, even, you know, the big guys in the trenches, right? So I think that's sometimes lost.
From everything, thinking about NFL, right? If I remember, Dwight, correct me if I'm wrong. If you're a wide receiver and you catch the ball on the sideline, you need to have at least 2 feet in.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then college is 1 foot.
Right.
Just that minor difference changes the entire outcome of a game. Right. But then also for quarterbacks to know and read what's going to happen before it actually happens, audible in the moment, there's a degree of studying that has to happen in advance. So when they get to the line, oh, this is now easy. Like, look at Patrick Mahomes. The dude is sick. Right. Incredible of like how he studies the game, how he approaches the game. Tom Brady, the same. We can go down like other athletes, different positions as well, where it's being able to anticipate. It doesn't just happen out of like chance. You have to be able to go watch and dissect what happens each play, where someone puts their foot. If they put their foot in this space, they're probably doing this. So now I have more of an advantage because I've studied my tape. I know what's happening. Mm-hmm. So now I do have an advantage. And I think that's where we start to see the skill difference where who's going to decide to stay and watch extra film. I think it's I don't know if it's a Netflix series or ESPN 30 for 30, but the Johnny Manziel one, the dude watched no film. But then we see how his career plays out, right? Mm-hmm. And like all respect to him. But at the same time, I think Dwight's talking about this as well. There's the eye in the sky. They know how much film he watches. Everyone is watching every single move that you do, and everything has to be calculated almost to the T because you never know like what's going to happen. So to think that you're just going to get away with something, no, not at all. You think you're going to get away with it. Someone just took your spot. You just lost the game. You just cost us 4th and inches because we knew this about you. We scouted you. Like the amount of film and scouting that analysts do blows my mind.
can I
like
just,
how do you know all those details?
Can I just say that in addition to all of that, they are grown ass men. These are grown ass men protecting their job. And so they're going to get every angle, every step that they can get to make sure that they kick your ass when that ball is snapped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think we talk about that part enough. It's always, they hit hard. They run fast. Yeah, they study a lot. And it's always interesting where I've seen several athletes who they're not that great in school academically, or maybe they don't choose to be that great academically, but they can show up in the film room and they can study that thing like nobody's business and know it backwards, forwards, left ways, sideways, and they get it. And I wonder if that speaks to like the piece of they really love it, they enjoy it, they're good at it, so they go excel at it, or I go put more effort in it. School is hard. It takes a different amount of effort. I don't really know. And what's the payout for that? Right. I'm going to go invest in this football thing because I know there's a bigger payout and I'm already good. So might as well. And now that we shift with the culture of NIL, kids are already getting paid now. I use that word kids specifically because they're 18 to 22. Mm-hmm. And some of them are making more than assistant coaches in other sports at the same university. So why would I not go invest more into this sport? I might as well.
This is the 80% Mental Podcast. I'm here with Senior Associate Athletics Director for Student Athlete Health and Wellbeing at the University of North Carolina, Dwight Hollier, and Performance Consultant Dr. Adrian Ferreira. We've been discussing the psychology of the clash of collision sports, particularly American football. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast at 80%mental.com or wherever you're listening. Follow us on social media at EPM Podcast on Twitter or at 80% Mental on Instagram. And, you know, like, share, tell your friends, all that stuff. We've been talking about some of the off-field mental aspects of the game, the amount of precision, the amount of studying that's involved in the sport. I want to talk about some of the physicality as well, because injuries, dealing with injuries in sports like this is perhaps heightened relative to some other sports. One thing I think we can't really talk about this without touching on some of the recent research on concussion in American football in particular, suggesting that, you know, participating in these repeated collision sports like football may have a direct link to long-term inflammation in the brain. There's a growing body of research shows that collision sports that involve repeated, even low-level blows to the head, so football, even soccer as well, and boxing, might lead to problems down the line with dementia and other forms of cognitive disorder. So, you know, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that, because it's sobering stuff. And I feel like knowing that would have an impact on me as an athlete psychologically. And I wonder what your take on this is. Dwight, I want to start with you if that's okay. Give me your thoughts on some of that stuff.
Yeah, it certainly creates a calculation that you have to make about the choices to play or not to. And we certainly know a heck of a lot more now than we did when I was playing in college and even in the pros. The things that we've learned about head trauma and concussions and even the treatment of concussions has changed tremendously. And if I think about that, and it's a calculation that athletes have to make every day that they decide, because they're informed. These are informed choices that they're making to participate in football. And a lot of them, like me, do choose to continue to do it. I talked about the love early on, but I also want to say that I would not have been a college student without the opportunity to play football. That was my pathway. I'm a first generation college student. I talked about my older brother who was a football player. Unfortunately, he strayed the path and didn't end up in college. Ended up in other situations. And so I was a first generation college student, and going back and looking at things and knowing what I know now, I do it the same way. I'd make that decision again. And it is a calculation that a lot of folks have to make. And I would do it because I it was my opportunity. It was my way out. And I know that there are guys who make that determination, that decision. But I also know that there are people who are playing the game out of the sheer love that I talked about as well. Understanding that there are chances that they take, but injuries happen, and injuries happen in every sport that's played. And the great thing about athletics, as far as treating those injuries, is that as our knowledge progresses, so does our ability to respond to those injuries and challenges that happen. And I think that, you know, at University of North Carolina, we have a leading edge concussion program that is helping our student athletes to understand the challenges and move beyond the injuries as they happen. Not move beyond, but to get the best treatment possible to help mm-hmm. them and when they experience a concussion. Injuries are going to happen, and I'm grateful to work with a professional staff that helps student athletes navigate those injuries and rehabilitate from those injuries. With football, it is part of the game. Injuries are going to happen.
I think within football, but also other sports, we're trained to push through adversity, push through pain at times, right? Mm. I'll even self-disclose. My daughter recently started playing soccer this weekend. She's in a soccer game. We got there late, totally our fault. We went to the wrong field. That's a different story, right? But then she gets there. She's in the game for like 4 minutes. And it's like, I need a water break. And the ref is about to stop the game. I'm like, nah, you don't need to like come out. Like, keep pushing through. My wife like taps me like, I was like, all right, my bad. Right. So don't need to push through. But right, she's nine.
Yeah.
I know that was the message for me when I was younger. Like, drink water from the water hose. You don't need any water to get through. You'll be fine. Just keep going. Mm. So when we learn that message younger, but then it's also reinforced. See, look, you push through and you're fine. Okay, I can keep pushing. I also want to recognize there's a threshold that we also have to increase for ourselves. And what's the tolerance we can take? So as some of that happens, I don't think I like put my daughter in a dangerous situation. She got water, just so everybody's clear. Don't come at me. But I do think that there's an element where we do have to push through some adversity. And I'm thankful that there's more policies and procedures that are in play that takes that decision out of the athlete's hands. Knowing that they've been trained to say, I'm going to push through it. We now have doctors, athletic trainers who are like, no, here's your limit. You can't push through this. Here's our protocol. You need to go through. You go through this protocol. You pass. You get to continue. You don't pass. Don't pass. Go. Don't collect $200. Right. But the athlete is going to want to push through. No athlete wants to come off the field. We've already talked about this. If I come off the field, someone's taking my spot. Someone takes my spot. I don't eat. That's not a good thing. But now we're in a position that we have some safeguards that are in play, right? So I do think that's helpful, where in the moment the emotions are high, someone who's not going to be as emotional is going to make a medical decision for you. So it puts you more in a good good headspace, right? But also protects your safety. And I think that person is more likely to say no, because if they don't and they throw you back in, now it falls on them. So they have to think about athlete safety. And I've probably heard more athletes recently talk about, I've had X number of concussions. I got to be careful. So I think there's more discussion around it, and athletes have a heightened awareness. But I don't see any slowing down in people playing football anytime soon.
Right.
So like we have a lot more information, a lot more knowledge. We still playing football. And aside from like policies, procedures, not much has changed to my knowledge. And I think this is where things can probably get different of how do we teach, like thinking about rugby, there's always a comparison of how we tackle in rugby, how we tackle in football. Mm-hmm. There's like penalties now if you're targeting with your head in football, right? Like rugby, I'll never tackle like that. That's not what it is. But in American football, we glorify that. There's like the top 100 hits every New Year's. That's what we glorify. People tune in to see that. And that's what people pay to see. When I see it, I like cringe. I'm like, I can't watch it. Because I've seen the athletes like days after when they're like, man, that hit like messed me up. I still have a teammate. I remember he got hit playing football. Then he came into basketball. This dude was throwing passes left and right. I'm like, bro, we not even over there. But I'm like, you're not right anymore.
Yeah.
Because like the hit you took in high school. And it's like, that changes the trajectory of someone's life, not just their career. It changes the trajectory of life. But I think about how are we teaching fundamentals at a young age, and how does that affect people developmentally, which is going to lead to other injuries or success, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And Dwight, you said you're responsible for dishing out hits rather than taking them. You dished out a lot more hits than you took in your time. Talk to me about the psychology of that, right? Your job is to go out and hit people over and over and over again.
Right.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah. Let me also say it sounds bad when you say it like that. You know, it was within the rules.
Everyone has a job.
Within the lines, you know.
Not in the parking lot afterwards.
Right, not in the parking lot. I had a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing going. You know, I cut it on when I needed to.
Okay.
But it was a mindset that, as Adrian mentioned, it was reinforced to you know, you wanted to blow guys up because somebody was going to pat you on the back for it. And I remember I mentioned the Kill the Man game that we played early on in my early years of football. I learned how to fearlessly hit because I was fearlessly hit by a younger kid, I think we were the same age, but he was a smaller kid. Mm. And this kid hit me with, like, he threw his whole being into me. And I said, ouch, you know? And I look, and, you know, you get up and you look at him and you're like, how did this little dude, this gnat, hit me like that? And it was that, it was a fearless hit. And I, from that, I took that and tried to replicate it. And at each level of being that fearless hitter, like, I'm going to hit you. I'm going to, you know, hit you so hard, your mama going to feel it. Like, that mentality that you develop, it became who I was and what I did. And so I was a hitter. I was a heads up technique hitter. I didn't put my head down. I saw what I hit. I was taught to hit the right way. But I was going to try to blow you up. And that mentality and that ability gave me the opportunity to play in the NFL. You know, it opened doors for me. And I used it every chance I got within the rules. And I couldn't have fear. If I had fear, if I hesitated, it was bad news for me. And the one time that I hesitated, and I didn't really hesitate, I was a wedge on a kick return. So kick return, you have the front line, five or six guys on the front line, and then you have the second line, and there's three or four of us back on the second line, two returners. I was the middle guy in the wedge. And when the ball's kicked off, the front line comes back to block the guys individually. The wedge forms to protect the runner behind us. And that's that back line. And so guys who are called wedge busters on the kickoff team would come to try to break that wedge to get to the back that was behind us. We used to lock arms. We didn't do that often, or we get shoulder pad to shoulder pad and go forward and try to, you know, roll over whoever we could get.
Mm.
Well, this one time that I didn't see what I hit, I turned my head slightly, and the defensive back that was covering this kick launched into the side of my helmet. And for how many minutes, I couldn't hear or see anything. I blacked out. They came, got me, took me to the sideline, and our offense had the ball, went 3 and out. So that means that, you know, there was a TV timeout, whatever time that is. Offense took the ball, ran a play, didn't get a first down, ran a second play, didn't get a first down, ran a third play, didn't get a first down. And then we had to punt, and I was on the punt team. So I'm on the sidelines trying to collect my marbles that spilled out on the field. And they're, you know, giving me how many fingers got up and here's smelling salt. And after those three plays, TV timeout, I was back on the punt team and played the rest of the game, dazed and confused, and played okay. Didn't make it, you know, didn't make any mistakes, but don't remember most of it. You know, I watched the tape afterwards, and I didn't do anything that was out of sorts, but yeah. I don't remember what I did.
More luck than judgment.
He said his marbles spilled out. Did we hear that? Marble. But I think this goes back to what I was saying, right? He's going to go play.
Yeah.
Football players are going to go play.
Right. Right.
But if that wasn't
the smartest
I don't know if it was going to happen.
Well, yeah. Now,
and I'm not even faulting you for it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not faulting you for it at all, like whatsoever. Like we see the same thing in basketball. I've definitely twisted my ankle, turned my ankle. I'm good. I'm gonna run this sucker off.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah, I got an elbow to the head. I'll be fine. I'm good.
Right.
I see two rims when I'm shooting, but I'm right-handed. I'll shoot at the right one. So, it's part of the sport. Yeah. The sports in general.
I'm interested in a little bit about recovery, and you know, we talked about the physicality, and you know, you think about basketball, you play like every other night. Baseball is like 140 something ridiculous games in the season, right? But football, you play 16 games, a week between each game, sometimes 2 weeks if it's a bye week, right? So the importance of that recovery from a physical point of view is really important. But psychologically, I imagine there's two things. Whenever I play basketball, you have a crappy game, there's like a chance to put that right immediately or a couple of days after. Like you have a crappy game in football, you got to wait a whole week to put that mistake right, to go out and play better. So psychologically, there's that. But yeah, there's the recovery element of it as well. You know, talk to me a little bit about the importance of recovery from a physical point of view and from a psychological point of view as well. Adrian, from your point of view as a psychologist, what kind of things might you work on with athletes kind of week to week in terms of that recovery and preparation maybe for the next game?
Yeah. And just for clarification, not a psychologist, LPC, licensed professional counselor, which is fine.
Sorry, different terminology in the
good.
UK.
I'm just trying to make sure all my license everything.
Yeah, sure. I'll put a disclaimer in the episode description.
But yeah, I think the element of how do we move on, knowing that mistakes are part of the game. We never want it to be the mistake that costs us the game. But it definitely happens, right? We see it with kickers, wide receivers, the person who gives up the touchdown. It's like, hey, you're supposed to be covering that person. That's on you. Mm. Those things happen. So how do we almost like normalize that and not let it happen again and start to spiral are the big things I start to talk about with athletes. How do they take it as a moment of, I still got to go study. I still got to work on my craft and understand my craft to a T, and knowing that there's a point of like preparation where I think it can be detrimental. Every athlete has to figure out what that is for them. Right. But if you can put yourself in a position where you've done all you can and they got lucky on something or something slipped and damn, that got me. You just got to call that one and say, this is just what it is. Right. We always can't win every game. Some people get lucky and they have some great seasons. But I think mistakes are part of the game. But does that one mistake affect your confidence? Does it affect your identity and who you are? If so, then we have some other areas that we need to work on from the mental side. Like that one mistake shouldn't take you down a spiral. I'm the worst player ever. I should never play the game. Like, wait a minute. Right? Like, let's walk me back. So now I think about all the confidence you had. Was that false confidence? And how do you get a sound base of where you need to be so you can go perform day in and day out, regardless of mistakes that happen? And I think some of the best athletes, they know they're going to make mistakes and they know why, and they already know like how to get over it and how to move forward, because they know if they're thinking about the last snap, when they're on the current one, they're probably going to make another mistake. And if they compound those mistakes, someone else is coming in for them. So I think about how do we minimize compounding errors? And that's where like I've seen and had the opportunity to like do a lot of mindfulness activities with some athletes, and how do we get back to being in the moment? I think at one point we were doing like some mindful breathing exercises like twice a week with a football team I was working with. And it was amazing for some of them hearing that this is the one time where I can like be present. Whatever else is happening, like, doesn't matter because this is the moment that I need to be in and just enjoy this. So I think about that from two points. If you can refocus and regather yourself within this moment here, and we're training that twice a week, it gives me more hope for when you're on the field. If something does happen, all right, how do I get back to this moment? And then another layer is, if this is the only moment you get to like rest in your day, all right, cool, I did my job. Right. And I think for me, those are like the little wins of like, hey, I learned how to quiet my mind. I've learned how to just take a second for myself and gather myself, take the breath. I've learned how to come back to the moment. I've learned how to reground myself after whatever happened on the field. I now have some strategies, some tools to go get better in the next moment. So in those moments, I feel like, all right, I did my job. I'm giving you some skills to like get to where you need to be. And those just like little pieces of what chip away at it.
Dwight, what about you? You know, thinking about your career, what kind of things would you do to A, recover psychologically from the game that you've just played, and then sort of transition into mentally preparing for the next game?
Well, I'm probably not the first former athlete to say that, you know, I wish I had done a better job taking care of myself and recovering. The way our week was structured and way it currently is structured with a lot of athletics teams, football teams in particular, is, you know, intentionally, you know, we'd watch the game the day afterwards, and then we were installing the next game, installing the next scheme for the upcoming game, and therefore pushing whatever happened in that game behind us. We'd watch it and then, you know, make corrections, and then we put it behind us and start to focus on that next game. And so you couldn't dwell on what you did wrong. You couldn't dwell on what you did right. It was all about let's fix it this day. And then this next day, we're going to focus all of our attention and energy on this upcoming game and making sure that we are executing the right way. And so when I think about things from a recovery framework, doing things to take care of yourself, doing things to as Adrian mentioned, mindfulness activities to reframe and refocus on what was next. Like I said, I wish I had done a better job of that when I was an athlete. I think that technology wise, and I just think about the things that our student athletes have now to show them that if they practice self-care, if they rest, if they eat right and take care of their bodies, then they will have a better level of performance than if they don't. So they get this feedback. And I wish that I had gotten that feedback back in the day, or knew as much as is known today about that. And I think that there were some athletes who had the key, who took advantage and took care of themselves and made sure they did X, Y, and Z. And some of those guys have gold jackets now, are in the National Football Hall of Fame, National Football League Hall of Fame. So I think that there's things that the framework of the football team helps you to move beyond that challenge that you had the week before.
I want to throw out this other level too, because I do like the mental side, but like thinking about strength and conditioning, exercise phys people who run all the data, the load that are on people's bodies, everything that is monitored today, right? So we're able to shift training programs, shift practices, how much people are taking on within the day. The athletic trainers who either set up massages for athletes, for those athletes who for some reason missed their massage. I'm like, what's wrong with you? Someone is paying for massage for you that you don't have to pay for. You don't have to schedule. You just got to show up. So much more is provided for them. The Normatec sleeves for your legs, the Hypervolts, whatever Theragun you got, the stretching, the yoga person who comes in. Like, if you're an American football player at a Division I level, there's a lot of resources there for you. That's a big generalization. But many schools like have some of these resources that think about recovery for our athletes from the physical side. And even if we want to get into like the substance use, maybe we don't deep dive, but there's professional athletes who have been on record saying they were either high, drunk, playing in an NFL game at a high level. And I think that translates down to like the college level, where some athletes think they can do that, but maybe not. Some of those athletes who are at a high level, they're freak athletes. Let's just say that. And they can probably get away with it, but not every high school or college athlete can get away with it. But I think there's this narrative like, well, this person smokes weed. Look, they're in the NFL. They're great. Yeah, that person's 6'8", or runs a 4.4. You don't. You don't at all. And you're not close to that. And there's still some college athletes who can get away with it. But I think that starts to like almost become the norm. Well, this person does it. Look, they're so good. Maybe that person can. I think some athletes have to figure out what's going to work out best for them. And they have to make the decision. I definitely seen some 6-foot receivers who are like, yeah, I'm not 6'5". I can't go smoke. I can't go party. I can't go drink because I'm already a step slow. So they've decided on the front end of how to take care of their body and let the other 6'5 person do whatever they want, because the 6'5 is going to show up. They're going to outcatch you regardless because you're 6 foot. So it's like playing the advantages that you have, but also figuring out what's going to give you the best advantage. And if it's going to give you the best advantage at college, what's going to give you the best advantage at the next level if you get that opportunity to go?
So this is the 80% Mental podcast, and I'm here with Adrian Ferreira and Dwight Hollier. And we've been talking about the psychology of the clash, collision sports, basically just getting knocked on your ass and getting up over and over and over again. So, guys, look, we've got to know you on a professional level, and something that I've been doing recently on the podcast is trying to get to know our guests a little bit more personally. So I've got a little game to play, if that's something that you're both up for.
I love games.
Dwight's like, nope.
Hey, if I have to.
Well, you don't have to. But it, basically, I've got four sets of questions. They're just kind of quick fire questions. So either or, last time, have you ever, or deep and meaningful. And I'm going to ask you between you to pick a number between 1 and 4. And I will select one of these virtual envelopes, which is full of quick fire questions.
You got virtual envelopes. I love this.
Number between 1 and 4. Dwight's saying number 3, which is either or. Okay, so quick fire questions. First thing that comes into your head.
Can I answer this too?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, in fact, we'll start with you, Adrian. Mountain holiday or beach holiday?
Beach. I'm a Cali boy.
Dwight?
Beach. I'm a Virginia boy, but
okay.
Yeah. East Coast. All right.
Getting up early or staying up late, Adrian?
Night owl.
What about you, Dwight?
That's a tough one because weekends I'm a night owl. Weekdays I'm up early, so I'm gonna say night owl though. I'll lean on night owl.
Okay, fair enough. Peanut butter, crunchy or smooth?
Ooh, crunchy. Depends.
Okay, Dwight said crunchy.
Crunchy.
Adrian said depends. Dwight, you and I can be friends. Adrian, I'm not sure yet.
It depends on the mood. I'm a moody eater. Okay. I'm going to throw that out there. So there's sometimes I want crunchy peanut butter in my PB&J, but then there's other times I'm like, I'm good. Just give me some soft squishy.
Fair enough. All right, we could dive into that, but I'm not going to.
It's a whole different episode.
Yeah, exactly. messy desk or clean and tidy desk?
Messy.
Month without television or a month without music, Dwight?
Month without television. Easy.
I don't own a television.
Okay, fair enough. So that's easy.
Wow. Uh-huh.
I'm good.
share food or do not share food under any circumstances?
Share food. Sharing food brings friends.
Okay.
Share food. I'm going to put this, I cook for our house.
Okay.
If I don't cook, sometimes we don't eat. So I'm just, don't play this for my wife, please.
Yeah. I always bring extra just in case. I was at a training the other day, had a gang of fruit snacks. They're like, what's that for? For you. Here we go.
Oh man, that's sweet. I'm firmly of the opinion that if we're out at a restaurant and I've ordered food, that's my food. Oh. Do not like...
Okay.
Yes. If you wanted some, or you should have ordered some.
I will begrudgingly give a forkful, but I have an attitude when I'm given it, but I try to have a good face.
Fair enough. And then the last one, seeing as we're talking about it, you mentioned it earlier, new kickoff rules. Are we for them or against them? What do we think?
What's the rule?
I haven't seen it.
They've changed the kickoff rules now. So basically, because like 90% of kickoffs just basically went out to the end zone and it was a touchback, and it was really boring and totally pointless. Yeah. They've completely revamped the rules now. So it's like if you haven't seen the new rules, then I'll just edit that question out completely.
I know that the one of the new leagues, the USFL, they were trying out. Lining the two teams 10 yards apart, kicking to a guy who's 20 yards behind them. And then that's the kickoff. And so there's less full speed collisions.
I think they've adopted that rule in the NFL from this season going forward. So.
That'd be interesting. Yeah. I don't think I'm for that.
Yeah.
Anything for player safety, I'm for it.
All right. Oh, well, and that's it. That was my little game to get to know you better. So thank you both for playing. I appreciate it. And I feel like I've definitely got to know you a little bit better.
Nice.
Although, Adrian, you're going to have to clarify that crunchy, smooth peanut butter thing at some point.
So I'll do it later.
We can do it later. Yeah. we don't need to get into that. So this is the 80% Mental podcast, and we're coming towards the end of the time that we've got today with my guests, Dr. Adrian Ferreira and Dwight Hollier. And Dwight, I wanted to talk a little bit about your current role, optimizing wellness with student athletes. Tell me a little bit about the sorts of things that you're doing. You know, you talked a little bit about the concussion program. You talked a little bit about kind of helping athletes through some of their transitions. Like, what kind of things are you typically doing to try and help your student athletes?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. You know, one of the things in my role, I am less hands-on. I am in an administrative role, and part of my oversight is our health and well-being, the health and well-being of our student athletes, which means sports medicine, strength conditioning, nutrition, sports psychology, the oversight of those areas or collaboration with our sports medicine team and our director of sports medicine, Dr. Mario Sioka. And in my role, it's really about understanding what resources we have, what resources we need, and how are we executing our responsibilities to make sure that our athletes are performing at the highest level. And so my role is more, you know, sort of in the background, encouraging our staff to make sure that we're doing the things that we need to do. The other part of my role is I'm a sport administrator for three sports, volleyball, track and field, and women's golf. And that involves working with the programs to, again, handle the administrative responsibilities, to be the eyes and ears for our athletic director. We have 28 teams here at the University of North Carolina. And through my engagement with those teams, I get to know the athletes. I get to make sure that I'm supporting the head coach and staff and the needs and you know, any big need or ask that they have that needs to be approved by administration, I help to walk that up to the different departments that need to act on whatever it is that they're requesting. So my role is supporting the student athlete from afar in some ways, you know, and making sure again that we have the right resources. And it really is, you know, how do we optimize the student athlete experience through our wellness resources? And that's a thing that we strive for every day.
And just to I guess finish off with, then, this is a question for you both, bringing it back to the topic today, the psychology of the clash, those collision type sports. Adrian, I'll come to you first. What kind of things do you think we might need more of, or those athletes might need more of, from a mental skills or a psychological support point of view? What do we need to be doing more of? What do they need more of?
This is a tricky answer because there's a lot that has changed. And I think just hearing Dwight talk about the services that are available, the physicians, athletic trainers, massages, there's a lot that is done. And this is a struggle for me because I think about, are we setting people up for success long term? Because so much is done for them.
Yeah.
So it's how do we take away some so they can have like the initiative, the motivation, the decision-making skills to do it. Like prime example, if you're playing college sports, the likelihood that you do your laundry is very, very low. The likelihood that you make your own meals, very low. Yeah. Decide your classes, very low. So we're pulling a lot of decisions away from people who eventually going to stop playing their sport. And then can they make decisions later on in life? And it's always funny to me when I talk with coaches and I'm like, this kid can't make any decisions. Why would you expect him to make decisions? You've told them where to go at 6 a.m. until 6 p.m. at night. You've told them where they're going to eat. You've told them what they're going to eat on the menu. You've told them where they're going to sit, literally in every meeting room. Here is your seat. You've told them where they're going to sit on the bus. You tell them what they're going to wear for the game. You tell them what they wear to travel for the game. Why would you expect them to make decisions? So if anything, how do we give back some of the decision-making power to the athletes so they can fail, mess up, and it's okay, like the ones where they can mess up, so they can have the learning experience? Because some of them, they're going to get into this world and just be clueless of like, how do I like register car insurance? I've literally seen some athletes who've been driven to other states to go get their passport updated. And it's like, wait, like how did you not know your passport was expiring?
Yeah.
How did you not know your driver's license was about to expire? And there's so much handholding. And to some degree, I understand some of it because for some athletes, it won't get done if they don't hold their hands. But at the same time, once they're done, who's going to hold their hand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if we can change that, that's what it is.
Yeah. It's such an interesting answer, Adrian, because it leads really nicely into what's going to be the last episode of this series, which is about retirement or transitions out of sport. Kenza is actually on that episode, and awesome. we pick up on some of those exact themes that you've been just talking about.
That's
there.
Awesome.
So it's such an interesting answer because it's not one that I think it's not one that we hear a lot about.
I'm glad I can provide it.
Dwight, I'm going to give the last word to you then. From your perspective, you know, what do we maybe need more of? Again, in terms of support or psychological skills, what are your thoughts on that?
I think we need more buy-in. Buy-in to, and we've come miles. And when I say buy-in, I'm thinking about stigma and the impact that stigma has as far as reaching out and getting help and accepting help. So it's not the doing for in the Adrian's way or Adrian's response, but it's more being willing to accept the help, to ask for the help, to recognize when you need help. And you know what I'm saying is, how do we get them to the help, accept the help that's going to help them to navigate these challenging spaces, have a conversation with a mental performance coach, with a clinician to better understand how different things are impacting them and therefore make different decisions about what they do going forward. Thinking about transitions and having conversations or paying attention to when there are programs on campus, things happening where they can be exposed to, a job fair, for instance, and taking advantage of going to a job fair and exploring what possibilities could help them in their transition. So, you know, I think just a willingness to engage in the resources that are available to them and to seek out the help and support that's going to help them to elevate their experience and move them beyond into their next opportunity.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. I think that's as good a place as any to bring things to a close. So I just want to thank you both so much for taking a little bit of time to talk to me today. This has been the 80% Mental Podcast. You can go and subscribe on the website, 80%mental.com, so you don't miss out on any future amazing content like this. You can follow us on Twitter at EPM Podcast or on Instagram at 80% Mental. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, all that social media crap. I just want to thank once again, my two guests today. So Dr. Adrian Ferreira, thank you so much for taking some time to come and chat to us.
Not a problem. Thanks so much for having me.
And Dwight Hollier, again, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been a wonderful conversation.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's been great.
Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you out there in listener land have enjoyed it. Leave us a comment. Get in touch. I don't know, all that stuff that I normally say at the end of episodes. It's been a blast, and I will see you next time. Well, I won't see you though, because it's a podcast, so we don't, you know.